You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. This episode is a Criterion-centric episode. I've got four Criterion Blu-rays from the recent months, and I'm going to run through them real quick. I'm going to kick it off with Election, Alexander Payne's movie from 1999.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who still believes that honesty, integrity, and fidelity are the cornerstones of our democracy, we suggest you wait for another preview before getting your popcorn. In the nation's capital, a new leader has found a place in the halls of power. But her story began in the halls of high school.
We'll move on now to the presidential race with three candidates running. The first is Tracy Flick.
One thing that's important to know about me is that I'm an only child. My mom is really devoted to me. She likes to write letters to successful women like Elizabeth Dole and Connie Chung and ask them what advice do they have for me, Tracy, her daughter.
The next candidate for student body president is Paul Metzler.
I just don't think somebody would do something like that on purpose.
I think you did it.
And if you want to keep questioning me like this, I won't continue without my attorney present. I do not often speak with you and ask for things. But now I really must insist that you help me win the election tomorrow, because I deserve it and Paul Metzler doesn't, as you well know.
The final candidate, sophomore Tammy Metzler.
I'm attracted to the person. It's just that all the people I've ever been attracted to happen to be girls.
You should stop her. She's not qualified.
We can't both run, can we? I mean, we're brother and sister, can we?
Tracy and I are totally in love.
In love?
Yeah.
So is this a moral situation or an ethical situation?
When I win the presidency, that means you and I are going to be spending a lot of time together.
Cast your vote for Tracy Flick next week. You won't just be voting for me.
You suck!
You'll be voting for yourself.
Who knew how high she would climb in life? I had to stop her.
Excuse me! Will you please be quiet?
Now.
Paramount Pictures presents an MTV Films production.
Order! Order!
Starring Matthew Broderick, Reese Witherspoon.
Hey, what happened to your eye?
What happened to your eye?
Are you okay, Mr. McAllister?
I'm fine.
On the road to greatness. Never underestimate an overachiever.
Looks like you could use a cupcake.
Election. Cast your vote.
Or don't vote at all!
So it's the back says, perky overachieving high schooler Tracy Flick, Reese Witherspoon, gets on the nerves of social studies teacher Jim McAllister, Matthew Broderick, to begin with. But after she launches her campaign for student body president and his personal life starts to fall apart, things spiral out of control. In Alexander Payne's satire Election, the teacher becomes unhealthily obsessed with cutting his student down to size, covertly backing a spoiler candidate to stop her from steamrolling to victory, and putting in motion a series of dirty tricks and reckless promises with uncanny real-world political parallels. Adapting a then-unpublished novel by Tom Perata, Payne grounds the absurdity of his central dynamic in the recognizable. The setting is his hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, and the accomplished cast is rounded out with non-professionals and distills his closely observed take on deeply flawed humanity to its bitter but stealthily sympathetic essence.
I had read, and this is something I didn't know, that originally the Election had a different ending, and that had been changed.
Right.
Can you, because I really had no, you know, can you talk about that process? What
yeah,
happened?
We wrote the ending of the film that was in the book. And then as we were testing the film, previewing it, testing it, it just wasn't playing well. And then even I was unhappy with it. And basically, I could go into details, but basically the problem is the book is very melancholy and somewhat funny, and then allows for this melancholy ending. The movie came out very funny, we think.
Yes.
Very funny, with a little melancholy, and then delivering us to a melancholy ending, and it felt tonally inconsistent. And a lot of what the humor had actually come from the editing,
yeah.
Because Election is a highly montage-heavy film and what Kevin Tent and I did. And so Jim and I set to work on, with the blessing of the studio, Jim and I went to work on writing something which we might have written had it been an original, and came up with that ending, and the studio spent an extra, $600,000 or $700,000 to let us do it, and that's it.
So the whole scene in Washington, that was all your guys'.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not from the book. Yeah, no, it works great. I mean, it's interesting because you'd never know that it wasn't planned that way from the beginning.
So this movie really made a big impression on me in 1999. I think it was, if not my favorite movie of the year, in my top two or three. And it has endured as a classic since then. Although I do find my relationship with the movie a bit complicated as I get older. I find it hard to sympathize with basically any of the characters in the movie, which is not a bad thing. You know, my wife and I talk about this all the time. She has a certain way in that she has to sort of feel like she can sympathize with at least one character in the movie for the most part. And I like to say that I don't need that, but the more I get older, the more maybe I do, kind of. Or at least the movies that I'm drawn to have characters that I ultimately, you know, find not too annoying. And the Tracy Flick character is, while incredibly performed by Reese Witherspoon, still really hard for me to tolerate, because I knew girls like this, I knew guys like this, you know, the grade grubby types and just obnoxious people ultimately, you know, that really weren't connected to others and were out for themselves. And I don't know, at least the movie does humanize her and give you a sense of why she is the way she is. But I think I'm much more fascinated by the other characters, the Tammy Metzler character in particular. She reminds me somehow of, I don't know why, but I associated this movie with Rushmore for some reason when it came out. And it might be just that they came out close together and they had quirky characters, but her character reminded me a little bit of Max Fisher from Rushmore, but I guess only in that she is like scheming to get expelled from her school and she has a certain flippant attitude. Not that Max is like that, but just that she stands out from her peers in that way. But she's very enjoyable. I did like seeing the actress show up on Freaks and Geeks, although I haven't seen her as much lately, so I'm wondering if she's on a new TV show that I just haven't been watching. But anyway, it's a really good cast. You know, Broderick is really great. People have talked about the parallels to, or the interesting irony of him having played Ferris Bueller, a famous like slacker, I guess, and then seeing him as a teacher is pretty amusing, I would have to say, in retrospect. But Broderick does a great job. He really does. He nails this character. The way that he talks, the way that he moves when he's running, it's really interesting. So, I don't know, there's a lot to like about this movie. Payne really, from a filmmaking point of view, does so many cool things, you know, just from editing to shot selection to camera movement. He's a real stylist, and on that level, I'm certainly pulled into the movie.
Who were the directors you admired, and who you admired also when you were younger?
In film school, in my 20s, I was, it was Kurosawa.
Really?
Yeah. And I have to say that the film that really tipped the scales toward my saying I have to go to film school is when I saw The Seven Samurai. Wow. When it was re-released in 82, and I saw it at the Castro Theater.
Wow.
I'd never seen it, and I thought, you know, I'll never make a film that good, but what nice footsteps to try to follow
in.
Yeah, I mean, because it was so cool and made such a, and it's still basically my favorite film.
Yeah.
And then I spent most of my 20s reading everything I could about Kurosawa, and I got deeply into Japanese cinema. Like as a kid growing up, it was a lot of basically silent comedy and Warner Brothers pictures.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The gangster pictures and
Jimmy,
you know, Universal horror, yeah. I was never too much into MGM movies, but it was mostly Warner Brothers and Universal and silent comedy.
Yeah, I like that. You know, I just like that connection to the past. I know you've expressed. I wonder if you talk a little bit about the films of the 70s. That's a kind of a crucial period in American filmmaking that a lot of directors today look back on with real kind of admiration.
Well, it's had a real impact on me, I think, only because even though I was watching, even in growing up and in my teens, fairly obsessed with older movies, still the new movies were 70s movies.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm born in 1961, and graduated from high school in 79. And so all the movies, and my buddies and I were all great movie watchers. And so somehow 70s, that golden, you never know it's a golden period when you're living in it. But that period formed my idea, I think, of what a commercial adult American film is. And it's just never changed. Really, in a way, your tastes lock in your late teens. You know, your taste in music and your taste in film.
Well, you know, I mean, I wanted, this is something I was going to ask you later, but I want to follow up on it now. Why don't we have more films like that now? What is going on?
You're a
on?
Critic. You tell me. I well, mean, you think about those things.
I do think I about do. Those things. Well, the whole way of business has changed. You know, the whole industry has changed in terms of what they're doing.
I mean, the common answers, which you could explain better than I, are the home run mentality with Jaws and Star Wars and all that. And, you know, I don't know. On the other hand, a deeper answer is that any time in the arts or even in politics or in culture, things happen in bursts, often in 10-year spurts that stem somehow from a historical necessity to have it.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly 70s filmmaking, you can in a way trace back to Italian neorealism.
Yeah.
And which came from a very specific historical necessity, both for culture to express itself and redefine itself, and a necessity for cinema, you know, a hunger for cinema. And then how that bled into French New Wave and auteur theory, and how that then affected American filmmakers who were dealing with such heavy, can I say shit here? With such heavy shit in the 70s with the war and all that, you know, and somehow that we needed a cinema which was very close to society,
to that,
you know, a mirror.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, and that, you know, maybe when we need it again, it's like Zapata.
Well, I'm hoping that now with all the heavy stuff going on, although that, somehow we haven't really realized how heavy everything is, like as a society, we're not getting it, we're hearing it, but it bounces off us somehow. But my hope is that now we need it again in a new way, and I'm hoping my optimism, I mean, it's a horrible time in general for the world and certainly for this country, but I'm hoping that that will translate into a good time for the cinema.
But anyway, definitely worth a pickup. The disc features a new restored 4K digital transfer supervised and approved by director Alexander Payne with 5.1 surround DTS HD master audio. Audio commentary from 1999 featuring Alexander Payne. This is a really good track. It's one of those that I remember listening to on the DVD when it came out and being like, yeah, this is cool. I like this. He talks about influences. He talks about, you know, why he did certain story things and really takes you inside in a cool way. This disc has a new interview with actor Reese Witherspoon, which is good. Something called The Passion of Martin, and that's Alexander Payne's 1990 UCLA thesis film with a new introduction by Payne. Also very cool. Trollside Election, a 2016 documentary featuring on-set footage and interviews with the cast and crew, also neat. Omaha local news report on the film's production, I thought that was interesting. And an essay by critic Dana Stevens, also very good. So great, you know, modern day classic, as it were. So pick it up. Next up we have Jabberwocky from 1977.
Jabberwocky! So terrifying that no one will be admitted to the theater until the last 10 minutes of the film. Only 10 people will be admitted to the theater during this film. No one will be admitted to the theater during this. The last 10 minutes only will be anyone being admitted under the age of 10.
This is from director Terry Gilliam. It's his first feature, I think. And the back says, amid the filth and muck of England in the Dark Ages, a fearsome dragon stalks the land, casting a shadow of terror upon the kingdom of Bruno and the Questionable. Who should emerge as the only possible savior but Dennis Cooper, Michael Palin, an endearingly witless bumpkin who stumbles onto the scene and is flung into the role of brave knight? Terry Gilliam's first outing as a solo director, inspired by Lewis Carroll's poem Jabberwocky, and made following Gilliam's success as a member of the iconic comedy troupe Monty Python, showcases his delight in comic nonsense with a cast chock full of beloved British character actors. A giddy romp through blood and excrement, Jabberwocky remains one of the filmmaker's most uproarious visions of society gone berserk. That's really well put. Yeah, this is an interesting movie. It, you know, doesn't quite reach the heights of his later work, but it has a lot of the early signs of a great auteur, a great stylish director in the making. There's a couple great shots where he puts the camera on like some kind of crane and it's moving around. I just remember seeing that and being like, ooh, that reminds me of the guy that would come later, you know? And it's just absurd enough and Monty Python enough to be really entertaining and fun.
For me, Jabberwocky, the opening shot of that movie, sort of summarizes a lot of what I love about your work, because it's the butterfly sort of flying, landing on the plant, and then a big boot coming down and crushing it. And it's got that sort of clash of beauty and reality.
Yeah.
And it's got the subversion of expectations, and it's also just really funny.
Yeah.
What sort of themes were you hoping to explore in your career? Were you thinking sort of at that level, or was it just going from film to film at that point?
It's really film to film. I mean, right. Jabberwocky intrigued me because I wanted to do a fairy tale.
Mm.
And I love the idea of it's basically a clashing fairy tale where the hero wins everything you're supposed to win in a fairy tale, but it's not what he wanted in life.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's saying something really interesting, and it's fun. And it was also, I was dealing with, you know, the difference between a businessman and a craftsman, which Mike is really the businessman. He's interested in selling barrels, not making beautiful barrels. He'd do it cheaper if it made him more money. So those things were there. And I always loved castles and Grimm's fairy tales and monsters, and here was a chance to do it. The whole business of making a film for me is kind of like climbing Mount Everest, and the team is what it's about. And some days one is behind and the other is leading. It's a constantly shifting relationship. I'm in the privileged position of being the final arbiter. I could say, that's why I say I'm not an auteur, I'm a filter. I filter what goes in, but half the ideas are not mine. Well, my wife says I always basically make the same film, I just change the costumes. they tend to be more than not about sort of this borderline between fantasy and reality and how the two things work. When you make a film, you really just, I mean, for me, it's just exploring some ideas, questions, the way the world is, the things that bother me in it. And then you put it out there, and then you see if people respond, if they discover they are not alone, that they see the world like I see it. I'm not just there to entertain people and send them home, making them feel everything's all right in the world, and you can just relax, just keep shopping. I don't want to tell the world that.
This director-approved Blu-ray includes a new 4K digital restoration by the BFI National Archive and the Film Foundation, approved by director Terry Gilliam with 5.1 surround, and audio soundtrack mix supervised by Gilliam. Audio commentary from 2001 featuring Gilliam and actor Michael Palin. Gilliam commentaries, always good, and this one's no exception. New documentary on the making of the film featuring Gilliam, Palin, producer Sandy Lieberson, and actor Annette Badland. Really neat to see these guys reflect on the movie years later. New interview with Valerie Charlton, designer of the film's creature, The Jabberwock, featuring her collection of rare behind-the-scenes photographs. Audio interview with cinematographer Terry Bedford from 1998. Selection of Gilliam's storyboards and sketches. Original UK opening sequence. Plus an essay by critic Scott Tobias. Very cool. One of my favorite critics. Next up, we have one called Hopscotch from 1980.
Take a look at this man. You've seen him before. He used to be one of our best CIA agents.
I could make a run for it, you know.
Come on, Yaska. You running, me chasing you, we'd look like Laurel and Hardy.
And this woman, another familiar face, her sharp tongue.
Oh, where have you been, you old goat?
And her quick wit.
You're insane.
Made her a doggone good spy. But now, these two are wanted all over the world for threatening to sing about every secret they know.
The Follett says that a guy that looked like him crossed over into Switzerland a couple of days ago singing The Barber of Seville.
Walter Matthau and Glenda Jackson are playing a game called
Hopscotch. Good title.
And from tall orders in Washington.
I thought you were taller. I don't remember you being this short. How'd you get so short?
High stakes in Salisbury.
How much can you afford to lose?
And fireworks in Savannah.
This is the FBI. We've got you surrounded.
Shoot, Ross. 8,000 panes and you hit one of them.
They tie the CIA in knots.
Joe Cutter is tied to a chair in his room. You better cut him loose.
Who is this?
This is Eleanor Roosevelt.
They run rings around the FBI and take the Kremlin for a ride by keeping one jump ahead of everyone.
He is back in London.
And you fly us to Martinique.
Bermuda?
The hideout in my house.
I need your help.
Oh, no.
no, I'm very sorry, no. Don't look at me like that, no.
Walter Matthau.
I'd like to charter a seaplane. Can I have my clip back, please?
Oh. Glenda Jackson.
You need a scorecard to know who the players are. Even then, it's fuzzy.
Herbert Lom. Sam Waterston. And Ned Beatty.
This is a mistake!
In Hopscotch.
I'm going to tell the truth.
Oh, it's a work of fiction. Oh.
Nobody's had this much fun since the days they made House Calls.
I'm just trying to have some fun.
We are both mad. Mad. Gone.
Mad.
Bad.
This is from director Ronald Neame, who did things as varied as The Poseidon Adventure and Horse's Mouth, which is a great Criterion DVD with Alec Guinness. I hope they upgrade that someday. This is a latter career release for him. And the back says, the inimitable comic team of Walter Matthau and Glenda Jackson stars in this nimble tale of international intrigue from master British filmmaker Ronald Neame. Based on Brian Garfield's best-selling novel, the blithe thriller centers on Miles Kendig, played by Walter Matthau, a disillusioned CIA agent who, with the help of a chic and savvy widow living in Austria, that is Glenda Jackson, threatens to publish his memoirs and expose the innermost secrets of every major intelligence agency in the world. Despite being in major hot water with his former colleagues, Kendig refuses to get in line. He's having too much fun. Set to the sounds of Mozart, this lighthearted send-up of the paranoid dramas of its era is an expertly crafted, singular take on a spy movie. Yeah, this is a very fun, light, breezy comedy that I am so glad that they put out on, firstly on DVD, because it was, I remember it being kind of rare on VHS and having seen it on VHS years ago, but I'm a gigantic Matthau fan. I love his 70s work. I love Charlie Varrick. I love A New Leaf. If you like those films, I think this is the next one you should watch. You know, it's right in line with that sort of thing. It's very funny. It also features Sam Waterston, Herbert Lom, and Ned Beatty, and all of them are entertaining. It's fun to see him mess with Beatty throughout the course of the film. Matthau does a nice job. But I don't know. If you're not a Matthau fan, I don't get it. He's just so endearing and so much fun and so much more than the Odd Couple role, which he kind of became famous for. I mean, he's great in that movie too, but I just feel like there's a lot of movies like the ones I mentioned that are a little underseen and underappreciated, and Hopscotch is one of them. This disc features a new 2K digital restoration with uncompressed Monaural soundtrack, interviews from 2002 with director Ronald Neame and writer Brian Garfield, Walter Matthau in a 1980 appearance on The Dick Cavett Show. Fascinating stuff. Trailer and teaser, optional broadcast television audio track for family viewing, plus an essay by critic Glenn Kenny. Lots of good essays. So, highly recommended. Hopscotch, definitely worth a pickup. And lastly, we have Le Samurai from 1967.
And now look at a scene from another masterpiece about a loner who's a killer. Le Samurai, directed by Jean-Pierre Melville in 1967 in France, stars Alain Delon in his best screen performance as an assassin for hire. And Melville's visuals place him at the center of a cold, impersonal world.
Qui êtes-vous? Aucune importance. Que voulez-vous? Vous tuez.
Here's a famous sequence often imitated from Le Samurai as the killer evades police in a cat-and-mouse chase on the French subway.
Contact rompu. Il est descendu sur le quai de Jourdain. Rétablissez contact à tout prix.
Looking at movies like these, you can see the roots of so many later films, and you can see greatness. And Le Samurai is a fascinating study of the existential hero, a man who has no reason to live or die and exists only to be consistent with his code.
The human condition, the existential man. This is one of the most influential films in film history, whether people working today know it or not.
Because it's influenced them through all of the imitation.
Exactly right.
And this man, who was so quiet and so ungiving of himself and of his secrets and of his thoughts, forces us to think about him, to try to read his mind, and that's a fascinating process.
And that's because here's another thing that's missing in movies today, the quiet. I'm talking about the visual quiet. The opening sequence in The Samurai is one of the great sequences in the movies.
You watch
because
that.
You come up to the screen because no one's throwing fast edits on you or explosions.
It's amazing. You look at the movie for about 3 minutes before you realize there's a person in the shot.
Yes.
And when he takes a drag of his cigarette and you think there's a man on that bed, it's as great a moment as any explosion or car crash.
No, greater.
Of course.
Because think of what happened visually, and I hope the directors out in Hollywood will listen, and watch the picture, obviously, more than listen to us, that your mind in the audience, you're up on the screen, you're searching the image. What am I seeing?
Your focus is with the film, not
with leaning back as they throw stuff at you.
This, of course, is one of the great towering classics from director Jean-Pierre Melville. I'm not sure if it's my favorite, but I definitely like it. I've heard some say it's not totally indicative of all the other stuff he would do because a lot of it is more dialogue-heavy stuff, but I think it fits right in. You know, it's definitely more of a mood piece, but all his films are that way. Just in terms of the Alain Delon performance, he's just so stoic and in this really amazingly cool way. The back says, in a career-defining performance, Alain Delon plays Jeff Costello, a contract killer with samurai instincts. After carrying out a flawlessly planned hit, Jeff finds himself caught between a persistent police investigator and a ruthless employer, and not even his armor of fedora and trench coat can protect him. An elegantly stylized masterpiece of cool by maverick director Jean-Pierre Melville, Le Samurai is a razor-sharp cocktail of 1940s American gangster cinema and 1960s French pop culture with a liberal dose of Japanese lone warrior mythology. Yep. Yeah, it's just this really interesting and compelling mix of influences. You know, Melville obviously has a great reverence for American Hollywood films, as it said, of the 1940s. But to see how that comes into him and comes out as this is fascinating. And obviously, Quentin Tarantino has professed his love for Melville.
I like the way certain directors approach genre and try to kind of mythologize it and make it their own, whether it be Sergio Leone going into Westerns and then creating a world of his own with Westerns, and then even with outfits, whether it be the long dusters that they wore and the poncho that the Man with No Name wore and the kind of almost Union outfit that Lee Van Cleef would wear. And those were like specific suits of armor for his character that were mythic. And if you went to France and you looked at the gangster films that Jean-Pierre Melville did, which were kind of very similar, even though he was going about it in a French way, it's very similar to what I was trying to do, where he was like, he'd take genre stories from Warner Brothers' heyday and then kind of do it in his French style and, you know, have it take place in Pagalle as opposed to Hell's Kitchen. But, again, he had a sense of style for his characters with their snap-brim fedoras and their trench coats and their raincoats. Yeah, Bogart wore that kind of stuff, but man, when you see Belmondo wear it and when you see Alain Delon wear it, wow, okay, it has this specific look. And that became the suit of armor for his characters. And then in the 80s, you had John Woo doing his version of gangster stuff with, you know, and he's taking from Melville. Right, he's taking from Raoul Walsh, he's taking from, you know, so everyone's taking from everybody else. But, you know, John Woo's characters had their own suit of clothing and their own glasses and the way they wore put a match in their mouth or whatever. So when I came along, it was my thing was to establish my own sense of style, my own sense of like a coat of armor for them. And mine was the black suits. That was the thing is in Reservoir Dogs. And Reservoir Dogs is a practical reason why I have them wear black suits. But by the time Pulp Fiction came around, it's more like, no, that's just my style. My guys wear black suits. And it, you know, and it's like Melville's trench coats or like John Woo's pigeons or Leone's dusters. There was this kind of my sense of style that I was trying to bring to the genre.
But yeah, just I remember Tarantino would say that the Melville films were kind of like the Sergio Leone Westerns, like how that was a crazy wild take on the Western and that Melville's gangster films were kind of like this crazy wild European take on American gangster films. And I like that analogy. I think it works. This Blu-ray special edition features a new high-definition digital restoration with uncompressed monaural soundtrack, interviews from 2005 with Rui Nogueira, editor of Melville on Melville, and Jeanette Vincendeau, author of Jean-Pierre Melville, An American in Paris. Archival interviews with Melville and actors Alain Delon, Francois Perrier, Natalie Delon, and Kathy Rosier. Melville Delon, D'honneur et d'ennui, 2011, a short documentary exploring the friendship between director and the actor and their iconic collaboration on this film. The trailer, and there's also an essay by film scholar David Thompson, an appreciation by filmmaker John Woo, and excerpts from Melville on Melville. Yeah, obviously John Woo, big fan of Jean-Pierre Melville, and it's great to see the sort of chain of influence from American gangster films to French gangster films to John Woo's gangster films, you know, just all that influence rolled through. I just love the idea of cinema as this malleable thing that touches one thing and touches another thing, and they sort of copy each other, but it comes out in this different way. I just love that about art in general, but that sort of grouping and how John Woo ends up where he is, and we get some of those amazing films, and how this is a part of it is just really neat to me. Anyway, so that is it for this Criterion-centric episode. Hopefully you've already picked these up, but if you haven't, I think these are all worth getting, and Criterion's always cranking out good stuff, so I know my listeners must be aware of their announcements on the 15th of every month and look forward to them like I do. So we shall see what 2018 brings past March. We already know what's coming through March, and it's some good stuff, but I'm very curious past then what else we'll see. Anyway, thank you for listening, and have a lovely and Blu-ray-filled week. Bye-bye.